Hello, everyone. Welcome. We're going to get started. We're grateful that you're here. As like the sun went down at 5 o'clock, I was like, nobody wants to leave their house, and I don't blame them. That's exactly how I felt. I was like, I don't even want to leave my house, and I'm supposed to lead this whole thing. So I'm grateful that some of you did leave your house to come and hear from Carrie and from me somewhat about this, I think, increasingly important subject. And we'll get into why we think that's so, or how we think it's so, that this is becoming an increasingly important subject. But I'm guessing if you're paying attention to our culture and our politics, you're seeing gender being sort of bantied about in various ways, certain language being used about it. We've all even gotten to the place now where I saw that there is an internal memo from, I think it was from the DOJ, Department of Justice, to the FBI, worried about domestic terrorism. And one of the things that they list as possible problematic subjects for domestic terrorism is gender ideology. That maybe we're going to have terrorists of gender ideology. I don't really know what that would look like, to be honest. But it's out there as this sort of boogeyman to be afraid of. So I'm glad that we're able to do this tonight to shed a little light on what is gender studies. Already. Let me say this before I forget. We've been having mic problems here, and we're trying to fix them, but they might occur anyways tonight. And then we'll do the whole swapping around. It's terrible, and I hate it, but we're all working together. Port 393 and us are working together to try and get this sorted out. So I'll just say that ahead of time. My name is Joshua Viss. I'm the creative director of Still Processing, and I'm set to become the first employee of Still Processing in January, which we are very excited about and grateful. Lots of people in this room have supported Still Processing, both by their presence and with their money, and without both of those things, this possibility, this year of trying this out for me, wouldn't be possible. So thank you. We do have a statement that I want to read for you. Still Processing exists to foster curiosity and kindness through conversation and community. We believe a better world is possible, as hard as that is right now to believe. And the values that shape us are honesty, hospitality, humility, and hope. I want to start with a really short video that I think speaks both to this conversation on gender, but also it speaks to me personally. And I think it might speak to some of you about some of the choices we all find ourselves facing right now in the United States in this current environment. It's interesting because this is the opinions, New York Times opinions podcast. So they will occasionally get two opinion columnists and then a third person to moderate it, and they'll have a discussion about something. In this case, the person who's going to be speaking in this clip, so it'll start out with the moderator, whose name I don't remember. Apologies to her. But you're going to hear from Masha Gessen, who is a writer for the New York Times, and they are non-binary and trans. We'll talk about what those things mean here as we go. They started their life in Russia and then have come to the United States since then. And they write on autocracy and gender.
The people you both wrote about are not professional activists. They're just normal people.
Sorry, let me make that make sense for you. There are two people. They both wrote about distance in different places. So Mosh, it's already started. Masha Gessen, who's the only one that's going to speak here after the question is asked, wrote an article about dissidents in Israel. And then the other person in this conversation who you won't hear from is Michelle Goldberg, who wrote about dissidents in the United States, in California. In that case, it was people fighting for people's rights who were being arrested and harassed by ICE. In Israel, it was people who were against the destruction of Gaza, essentially.
Trying to put their values into action at a particularly fraught moment in both countries. I'm interested to know, where do you think they found the courage to take on their government? Masha, why don't you answer first?
You know, that's actually the most difficult and important question. So the answer right away is, I don't know. I have some hypotheses, and these hypotheses boil down to, I think there are situations and there are people who find that the psychic cost of moral compromise is greater than the cost of acting, right? That for them to live in harmony with themselves and with their values, they have to do things that are scary, and they feel like they're not paying a greater price than they would be if they just sacrificed their values.
So just that definitely describes me and my journey to still processing really, really well. Essentially, I was going through what has been called deconstruction. And I started that 10, 15 years ago. And the psychic cost was, if I keep following this line of thinking, it might lead me out of my religion. It might lead me away. It's certainly going to lead me away from orthodox religious beliefs that I held, which were Christian beliefs. But it might lead me out entirely. And there will be costs associated with that. And I think a lot of people who come to still processing have been through a similar journey, which is like, do I want to follow where I think my intuition and the evidence, and my understanding of history and culture, am I willing to keep going, even though I know there's going to be cost associated if I keep going? Or would I rather the cost be psychic, meaning I have to pretend I believe things that I don't believe anymore? Well, now we're going to get zero mics, because if I don't change, I get to stay embedded in these communities, right? Or I get to stay embedded in a certain worldview. And the reason I think this is a part of still processing and a part of this conversation is inevitably, in lots of different ways, but probably most obviously for people who feel themselves to be transgender, right? Or just in any way don't feel like they fit in the box of the two binary genders, there is a huge price to pay to say, I'm not going to contort myself into one of those boxes. I can't. Often I think they would say, I can't do that. It's too big a cost for me to pay internally, right? Emotionally, psychically. Okay, let me introduce Carrie. So Carrie Bredo is an associate professor of psychology and the director of Women's and Gender Studies program at Hope College. Her teaching responsibilities include developmental psychology, psychology of gender, which is what we'll be focusing on today, psychology of romantic relationships, and advanced research in psychology. Carrie's research focuses on the development and maintenance of adult romantic relationships. She enjoys collaborating with her students on a variety of projects. When not teaching, researching, or writing, Carrie can be found spending time with her husband, Andrew, and their twin daughters, or sometime, less time than she used to. They've grown since she wrote this bio.
They're 15 now.
So it's tough. It's tough to get time with them in the same way. She still does enjoy music, reading, playing board games, and she's training for a marathon, yes?
Yes.
Congrats. That sounds terrible. But I am with you, and I support you, and I wish you the best. Let me ask you this. How did you end up studying gender? You grew up in this area. Mm-hmm. You grew up in a Christian family.
Yep.
Somewhat. We were talking about this earlier because we hadn't covered this before. You would say, you said sort of conservative, but not the most conservative. So you're not coming at gender sort of with that background, which is very similar to mine. You're not coming at the study of gender sort of primed to accept it and be excited about it. Is that right?
That would be correct. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I kind of stumbled upon gender. As you know, we were talking about before, it was not really a conversation at all growing up, right? It wasn't really necessarily like in one direction or another. I grew up in the Grand Rapids area, right? Grew up in the Reformed Church of America. Church was a really big part of my life. And I think that, you know, even in college, I never took a class, right, in undergraduate on women and gender studies. If you would have asked me, like, what is women and gender studies? I would have been like, is that a major? Like, it was not on my radar in just any capacity. And so I actually stumbled into gender through psychology. And so as I learned about psychology and human nature, right, and particularly I've always...
Was this also undergrad? Sorry to interrupt.
It was, yeah. So it was undergrad kind of leading into graduate school. So when I finished undergrad, what I knew is that I wanted to study relationships. And actually studying relationships is what got me really fascinated with gender, because relationships are so infused, right, with gender, right, with our expectations, with the way that we're interacting with all of that, regardless of whether it's, you know, a male and a female, two males, right, it's all gender, right? And so that's actually what really got me into that. I went to my graduate program. It's actually in human development and family studies, and so it's very interdisciplinary, and so there is a lot of, even though I wasn't majoring in, say, women and gender studies or something like that, right, a lot of the theory that was being introduced. And I think it was just a gradual process, right, of becoming more and more interested, of learning about it, of integrating it into things I research.
You feel resistance at any point?
To
what you were being, I mean, because you're being taught things that don't necessarily align with your upbringing.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think that by the time I was really learning formally about these things, I was in graduate school. I think had I taken, right, which would have been great for me, I would love to see myself in the WGS class in undergrad because I'm not sure how I would have responded to it. But I think... Women and Gender Studies. I think I would have felt a lot more internal resistance at that point than when I was right in graduate school, just because of other things that I had already kind of decomposed, right, and broken down, right, if we want to talk about deconstruction of beliefs and things like that. And so, yeah, I think that I didn't necessarily feel a ton of internal pressure, but definitely within broader circles, right? Like, if people who I went to church with, and they're like, oh, you do gender, right? And this is before gender became like this buzzword of like gender is now everything, right? Just in general, there was always this kind of, so I think there was, you know, maybe some external pressure, but nothing extreme.
Okay. All right. I want to play for you. And this may sound a little odd, but let's try it anyways. I want to try and, at the beginning here, have you sort of feel what gender can be like, maybe, with a clip that I made. It's a TikTok that I made. It exists on TikTok, and it harkens back to something we did talk about earlier. So this was almost a year ago. I think it was January of 20. Would that be 25? It would be. January of 25, we did something on men and boys. And we talked about patriarchy and how patriarchy affects culture and affects boys. And so I saw this trend, and I did something with it. And this is what it is. And I want to encourage you to just sort of watch. Pay attention to how you feel a little bit about what's happening, I guess. I'm being vague, I realize.
There's a really beautiful trend right now on TikTok, and it involves mothers and typically their almost teenage sons. And it reminded me of the really important work of bell hooks, sociologist, and specifically her book entitled The Will to Change, Men, Masculinity, and Love. So here's a quote, and here's two videos from that trend.
The first act of violence that patriarchy demands of males is not violence toward women. Instead, patriarchy demands of all males that they engage in acts of psychic self-mutilation, that they kill off the emotional parts of themselves. If an individual is not successful in emotionally crippling himself, he can count on patriarchal men to enact rituals of power that will assault his self-esteem.
Okay, so we're going to do the, it's the last time theory.
Okay.
You know what that is? Yeah. Where it's the last time that I'm ever going to pick you up because I don't remember the last time I picked you up, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
It's been a long time, and he's 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so can I pick you up for the last time?
Yeah, try not to cry.
Try not to cry, okay. Okay, hold on, let me take my shoes off. Okay. Okay, ready?
So there's this theory that you always remember the last time, and I want to remember the last time that I pick you up because I don't remember it, and you're going to be big one day and I won't be able to pick you up. So today on, what is today? Is today the 21st? Friday?
So I just want to sit in real quick and then and throw it to you for your thoughts on it. But there's no way that gender is not in play in what's happening there with these boys who are about to become men, right? And who are, in these two cases at least, there's still a softness to these boys, right? And I'll just admit one thing about myself. The first of the two videos makes me less uncomfortable than the second one. That because the way in which the boy breaks down in the second one just makes me feel a little bit more uncomfortable, which is all in some way tied to gender, I think. What did you think when you saw it?
Yeah, I mean, first thing, I don't have TikTok. And
you're lucky. You're blessed for that promise.
I'm very much not in these meme worlds. But, I mean, I think what struck me is that it had nothing to do with being picked up, right? I mean, that's not what the kids were upset about. Like, they weren't actually wanting their moms to carry them around still, right, at 11 years old. It's the underlying connotation that, like, hey, you're 11. All right, time to man up, right? Like, there's this expectation of separation, right? Particularly from others, right? And this sort of emotional fortitude that even at 11 boys know, right? That is going to be expected of them if it's not already. And like, that's what I think makes me the most sad about that, is that it has nothing to do with the actual picking up of a kid and everything to do with why are the kids upset? Well, because they're being asked, right, by society. Yeah. And maybe even by their own families, to become more emotionally disconnected.
And they already know that in some way.
They do.
Right? They may not know it consciously. They may not be able to, like, articulate it to you, to us. But something in them knows this is happening.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. We want to do some work on terms. Trend, sorry, right? We don't want to watch that again. Has anybody ever seen The Gender-Bred Person before? This is a great, you can find this online for free, okay? And it's a great way to start to get a handle on the terminology that's out there about, in this case, it's a bunch of different things, right? Gender is a part of it, sexual orientation. This thing is going in and out. Am I crazy? Not totally. Okay. But I'm going to ask Carrie to sort of talk us through The Gender-Bred Person so that we can get a handle on some of these concepts.
Yeah. So I really like The Gender-Bred Person. This is something that I've used in different contexts. And I think it's helpful, particularly in our kind of current cultural, social environment where gender has become this catch-all for everything.
Everything's scary.
Everything's scary, yeah. Right? And so in reality, and I think part of that is that gender's been conflated, right? But also gender is complex. And there's a lot of different components that are often referred to interchangeably, but they are not referring to the same thing. And so I like The Gender-Bred Person. It basically, a kind of key principles that it does is it points out, one, that we've got these kind of constructs that are related to each other, but they're not the same, right? And so that's your kind of, you know, gender-bred person on the side there. And so kind of looking through, right, and so often we hear kind of just gender used, but oftentimes gender is actually going to be broken down into gender identity and gender expression. And so gender identity is really referring to, right, how you are kind of internally feeling your gender to be in the world, right? And so this is going to be your own interpretation of, you know, what gender identity works for you the best, given what you think your options are, essentially, right? Where do I fit? And so this is all happening internally. Gender expression is how you are actually showing, right, presenting your gender to the world around you through. So the way you act, the way you dress, the way you behave, the way you interact with other people, all of that. Oftentimes, people, right, we assume that people's gender identities will align with their gender expression, and often they do, but not always. And so that is going to be the part that we can actually see, right? So looking at somebody, we can make inferences about their gender identity, but we don't actually know how they internally feel. We just know how they express and kind of portray themselves. So that would be kind of the gender component of it. Then we've got sex. So sex is when we are actually referring to the kind of biological, anatological things that are going to be often objectively measurable. And so these are things like what your genitals look like, what your chromosomes are, what your predominant hormone concentrations, all of that, right, would be what we are kind of putting into buckets for biological sex. In reality, if you look down at the little thing and it's saying sex assigned at birth, that's really just based on whether you have a penis. If you're looking, most doctors are not actually doing a full chromosomal screening, right, or any of these other things. They're looking, baby's born, does it have a penis, does it have a vagina? Based on that, we say it's a boy or it's a girl. If something looks right and is not immediately recognizable, right, so you might have a, you know, otherwise genetic female who has a large clitoris, right, and so you can end up with individuals who are going to be intersex that then sometimes are just kind of stuck in a box, right?
Is clitoris and penis before differentiation related?
Same.
Okay,
yep.
Thank you.
So it all comes from the same kind of genital tubule or whatever it's called. And so, yeah, so that is going to come from the same thing. And so a lot of individuals, right, who have intersex variation oftentimes that will be one of the places where we see that, because early on, right before hormones start to kind of play out during prenatal development, there is going to be all the same structure.
Got it.
So that is going to be kind of your sex element.
Can I just ask one
question?
Of course. Do you still do sex and gender as different? Or because it seems to me like this is getting a little bit messier. Like maybe because here, right, they're saying like sex is biological, gender is more complex, essentially. But I'm feeling like that's breaking down a little bit. Am I wrong?
No, you're correct. I would say if you go back a few decades, that was very much the way that people were trying to make sense of it, right? And that was progress because they're recognizing, hey, gender is complex, right? Like gender is not just something you pop out, right, being. But it also oversimplifies, right? And actually what you'll see a lot now in kind of scholarship is people write sex / gender. Because in reality, so many of the things that we're talking about, right, the ways that we behave, the phenomena, aren't easily gone and said like, oh, this is definitely because of your biology versus, like, they're so interconnected that in practice they become very difficult to separate. So we can give definitions and say here's sex. But even within sex, right, although we're saying it's biological, we also give our, it's happening less now than it used to, right, but surgically changing children's genitals to fit in the boxes, right, which then makes it social. And so it's complicated, right, in terms of what that looks like. So it's not a simple breakdown, but it can sometimes be a way of thinking at it at a basic level, yeah.
So I noticed on here, and I think this is curious and maybe worth noting, is like they didn't do womanness to manness, right? They
yes.
didn't. They did womanness to void, whatever, like... Is that because we're saying non-binary doesn't fit into womanness or maleness? Is that why this chart is like that?
Yeah,
am I getting
so you
that
can
right?
see, like, they're putting these as kind of spectrums, right? That's the other thing that the genderbread person is doing, is trying to challenge the idea that everyone will fit perfectly, right, into a, yes, I'm a man, yes, I'm a woman, right, these sort of categories. And so, interestingly, if you look, this genderbread person, I think this is like version 4, right? It says something.
It's 4.
Right?
It's version 4.
It's actually gone through a lot of iterations yep. over mm-hmm. time. And that even over the last, like, I think the first version was like maybe 20 years ago, 15. And so okay. it's been, and so it has evolved. So actually earlier iteration was exactly what you said. It was like, we go from masculine to feminine, right? And then over time it was like, well, this doesn't fully work, right? Because what do you do for the individual who doesn't really feel like they fit in either of those boxes, mm-hmm. right? And is trying to wrestle with what to do with that. And there's no other box for them. There's no other spectrum. Right. So then they don't know how to even label that. And so that's where you see a lot of this, right, where it's kind of like, and so I think it maybe makes more sense intuitively to people if you look at gender expression, right? Because, of course, all of us, regardless of your gender identity, are going to have different gender expressions in different contexts, right, in different settings, right? You dress differently when you're around people than when right. you're alone, right? All these things. And so we can see how, like, oh,
yeah,
I might
our
say,
own gender expression varies all the time.
It varies all the time,
yeah.
right? And I think people can understand that in a way how, oh, yeah, of course that could be a spectrum, right? Sometimes I might be really feminine, right, and quasi-masculine, and other times it might be this. I think that, right, it's much less intuitive when we start putting some of these other things on there, right? And so gender identity being one of them, where it's like, well, how can, right, you have neither of those things be true? But again, it's about, right, how you're kind of feeling yourself being able to fit into these social roles. Yeah.
So if we take Masha Gessen, who we heard from a little bit ago, trans but non-binary, where did the... How do you use this to understand Masha
yes.
in this case? Because that seems a bit more complex to me.
Yeah. So, I mean, both saying trans non-binary is really talking about gender identity here.
Yeah.
I don't know this particular individual, so I don't know what their expression is, right, in terms of where that kind of falls in femininity or masculinity. It doesn't tell me anything about what their genitals.
They were born female.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Transitioned.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the full history. It's possible that they at one time used he, him pronouns, but
sure.
then felt like non-binary was mm-hmm. more fitting. So now they use they, them. I'm still trying to get good at using they, them. It's not natural to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, that is largely, you know, this is somebody who probably would have been assigned female, right, at birth. So that would be kind of assigned sex at birth. Most likely, right, at least the obvious indicators, right, would have pointed towards that in terms of kind of
anatomical.
Anatomical sex. And so really the gender identity, we would be saying in this case, you know, to the extent that – and where it would fall on that could vary, right? So somebody who identifies as non-binary could identify as, hey, I don't really feel like a man or a woman. But they also could say that I feel kind of like a man and a woman, right? And it actually could be, or I'm kind of somewhere. So just knowing that, right, people can look at that really differently and what that looks like. But it's actually not uncommon for individuals who know that they don't fit in their own gender identity to assume, well, I must be the other gender, right? Because that's the other category they're aware of, right? We have to make sense of ourselves within the social constructs that we're given, right? And so they're like, okay, I must be this. And then it might be with evolution or time, some individuals might realize, well, actually, that doesn't really feel right or good or like a home for my body either, right? And so that can kind of evolve, but it's really all pertaining. So I'm pointing at this as if you can see. As if you can see what I'm pointing at. It's really all pertaining to that identity component of things. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. I mean, it makes as much sense as it can right now in our current circumstances, right, where everything is changing, right?
Yes.
And things are in flux. Let me ask you just one other thing, and that is, talk to me about gender dysmorphia. Because it's, I think some people, and I think maybe I had this view at one time, which is that every person who identifies as trans had gender or body dysmorphia. But that's not the case, right? Not everybody ends up feeling that. So what is gender dysmorphia or body dysmorphia?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, if we look at, you know, so I guess quickly before even jumping into that, just defining kind of what do we mean by transgender? And what, like, you'll sometimes hear the word kind of cisgender used, right? And so cisgender, if you hear it used, is really just referring to somebody whose gender identity lines up with the sex they're assigned at birth, right? So I was born, I was announced a female, and that feels like a home to me, right? That is going to reflect also my gender identity. Therefore, I'd be cisgender. Transgender, it's technically this broad umbrella term that means kind of just anybody who's kind of crossing gender boundaries. Practically and kind of popularly, we more specifically use it to describe someone whose gender identity does not match up, right, with what their sex was assigned at birth. And
right.
So we kind of use it a little more narrowly than the technical broad definition is. And so, yeah, oftentimes there's the perception that if I am transgender, if my biological, right, or kind of assigned sex does not line up with my gender identity, then I necessarily have gender dysphoria. And a lot of people do, right? But that's not necessarily the case, because what gender dysphoria is the actual distress that's caused by that non-concordance. The non-concordance itself is not dysphoria, right? And there are individuals who feel okay in their bodies, right, as they are, while still saying, hey, yeah, I can have this gender identity in this body. For other people, that's really not a livable reality.
Okay. Good. All right. I'm going to move us to talking a little bit about not all of this stuff. This is just something I pulled from her from her gender course. I'm not going to go over all this. But I do want us to talk a little bit about the major theories, which fall into sort of three buckets: biological, psychological, and social constructivist. And what's the difference? And I also think that they kind of relate to each other often, meaning they're starting to get squishy. I don't feel like the categories are all staying totally distinct. So I introduced here and then showed a compilation of clips from TikTok that raise like different ways in which gender shows up in our everyday lives. The first one was somebody remembering the difference between how girls played on the playground and how boys did. The girls playing more softer games and the boys playing like competitive sports. The next one is a young woman surfing is what you see. And there's a caption that reads, "Rich because I'm the first woman in my bloodline who can do whatever the fuck she wants. The next one is a gentleman who is listening to this soft, beautiful jazzy kind of music from Olivia Dean. She's a kind of a newer artist. But he's dancing in a way that's really tough because, as the caption says, you're at the Olivia Dean concert, but you still got to make sure they know you a thug. So he's worried about looking soft because he likes this soft music. The next one is a 16-year-old drag queen showing us his transition from no makeup to like full makeup, imitating one of the witches from Wicked. I think it's Elphaba. I think that's right. The next one is gender reveal. This one's really happy. But mainly what this shows is that gender shows up before a child is even born. All these expectations are created. And then I'm leaving the last one in for you to listen to.
See, because if I say women belong in the kitchen, you think I'm being sexist. But if I say the divine feminine flourishes when women honor their nurturing energy and feminine cycles and choose a soft life of taking care of the family and the home, you think I'm being enlightened, and that's the problem.
Okay. So lots of different stuff going on there, but all of it revolving around gender. And so we're going to try and just talk about these three broad theories and give some reference to the compilation. I think the easiest one is probably biological to explain. What do you think?
Yeah.
You take it however you want. Sure. Biological, psychological, and social constructivist.
Yeah.
Run
so, I mean,
through
I think,
those.
Honestly, you can even break it down a little bit into just two big categories, right? So, I mean, you have the nature and the nurture, right? That's where people kind of started with this. If we're asking the question of where does gender come from, right? How do we become gendered people? There are, you know, those are really going to be the roots of those two things, right? So the biological perspective, right, is going to be really kind of focused on this idea that, well, our gendered behaviors, our gendered beings are built into our DNA, right? They are going to be genetic. They are going to be hormonal. If you look, it's going to be tied into kind of like evolutionary explanations of like why men and women would have evolved differently.
In this one, this is everything. In
yeah.
the biological? Could
yes,
you say that?
Very much.
Okay.
So basically what they would be arguing, and if you looked at, say, like an evolutionary perspective on this, would be, well, because men and women, right, were different in terms of, right, their reproductive organs, things like that, they would have faced different reproductive challenges over time, and different things would have made them more likely to survive and pass on their genes. And over time, those things get passed on and cast on, just become part of our actual kind of psychological mechanisms. So that would be kind of your evolutionary biological perspective, which is saying that ultimately at its core, these differences that we see in gender, right, in day-to-day lives are innate, and they're due to sex, ultimately. So that would
innate
be kind of that
is
broad.
An important word
yes.
there, right? Like, there's not a lot of room for choice or
right.
for nurture in the biological paradigms.
And the
there's
one,
some room,
yes,
of course.
And that's where, I mean, you kind of mentioned, like, you are going to find very few people who are going to argue it is only biology now, right? Just like you will find very few people in today's, right, kind of, you know, conversations that are like, it is only social. Most people are acknowledging that it's going to have components. It's kind of like, what are you thinking is predominant, right? Which one are we saying has more weight is really where you're getting a lot of the theoretical arguments here. So, yeah, but if it's most strict thing, we'd be saying it's just, you know, a matter of your genes. Environment has nothing to do with it.
Right.
So that would be your kind of biological perspective. The other side, which is what you kind of mentioned, like a social constructivist perspective, that is this kind of bigger umbrella. Sometimes the psychological theories will fall underneath that. I kind of separate it out because I'm teaching psychology of gender. And so we're kind of focusing in on the psychological theory specifically. But a lot of them would be considered kind of social constructivist theories. And those are really what they have in common is the belief that whatever we begin with in terms of perhaps, you know, kind of sex differences is going to be fundamentally and qualitatively changed by society, right? That we can't understand gender apart from the environment in which gendered people are being raised in. And so the idea that essentially gender is something that we have to learn, that it's kind of, that's where you get the construction, right? That it's constructed over time. And so something I think we might, if we have time later, talk about, right? So Judith Butler's kind of theory of gender performativity would be an example of a social constructivist theory, this idea that we actually create gender through, right, kind of social processes and things like that. And so at its extreme end, somebody would say it's just that, right? If you took away society, there would be no gender, so, right?
And in this, some people would then see, say, the first thing in the compilation is like the girls were doing girly type stuff on the playground and the boys were having huge, in this case, they chose football, but other stitches were soccer or basketball. And it was like they were going all out and it was Super Bowl. You know what I mean? And so that can sound like a biological one, but the social is also in there. Like, how did the girls get to a place where on recess they wanted to do girl things and the boys wanted to do boys things? Is that purely biological? You're saying most people would not.
Right, I'd say, and that's where basically you've got people saying, so if I was coming at it from more of a biological perspective, I could point to things and say, well, maybe it's hormonal, right? And we do see like
competitiveness.
Yes, exactly, okay, right? Yeah. Competitive, and perhaps that competitiveness has evolutionary roots because men as hunters, right, would have needed. It's true. Men as hunters would have needed to be more aggressive and competitive for survival. That wouldn't have been as important for women who would need to be more communal to raise kids. Therefore, these things pass on. Right. So that would be how they would approach kind of explaining why we might see a recess difference of that sort. Whereas a social constructivist would come at it from more of an angle of saying, OK, well, how did kids learn what the child culture was on these playgrounds? Right. And what happens if the boy decides he wants to go play the hand game, right, instead of playing football or soccer, right? Well, he is going to very swiftly, right, receive social repercussions for that, right, which will be more or less severe depending on a particular situation. But it will make very clear every other five-year-old on that playground, right, make it clear that he's not in the right spot. And so we see that through those patterns of reinforcements and all of that. And the idea of social constructivist is that eventually we adopt that as the way we think about ourselves, right? And so eventually it doesn't feel like someone's telling me I have to go play soccer, right? Or someone's telling me I have to go do this. It feels natural, but that's only because we've received this training since we were born, if not before, which then leads back to the gender reveal, which I could go on a whole soapbox, but will not about gender reveal parties.
Well, it's – so I'm going to play a little clip. This is from Big Think. I don't know if you've heard of this, but they'll take scholars like Judith Butler and others and sort of do a 15-minute, we're not going to about to watch 15 minutes, don't worry, video to try and make somebody like Judith Butler, she's sort of like probably the most well-known gender theorist in the world. I mean, has anybody really unseated her at this point? Pretty
probably
tough.
Not, at least as well, yeah.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I had heard of her and I hadn't really studied gender. And so she's going to talk about here about her theory of gender, which you mentioned, which is gender as performative, which I think will make a lot of sense to a lot of you.
I think at the time that I wrote Gender Trouble, people treated gender as if it was a natural fact or a sociological reality, but they didn't treat it as something that you could make and remake. Performance is important to the extent that we do enact who we are. And anybody in performance studies actually knows that there are performances that we do in our lives that are not mere performance, they're not fake. When performative was first coined as a word, the philosopher J.L. Austin was trying to understand legal utterances. So when a judge says, "I declare you man and wife," you become man and wife once that declaration has happened. That's not fake. That happened. Now, what if we were to say that in enacting our lives as a particular gender, we are actually realizing that gender anew? We are making something real happen. When gay and lesbian people started coming out, or when trans people started living openly, something changed in the world. By appearing, speaking, acting in certain ways, reality changed. And it has changed. we are seeing the changing of terms. We no longer speak about family, woman, man, desire, sex in the same way. Even the Cambridge Dictionary acknowledges that something has changed. Okay, so when we talk about performative, we're talking about an act that makes something come into being or an act that has real consequences. We're talking about the changing of reality.
So, I mean, I think when I think of like middle schoolers and high schoolers, but especially middle schoolers, I think of people performing gender. And I think maybe it's most obvious with boys, maybe. But I mean, I remember being a middle schooler and a high schooler and thinking about how do I show that I'm a man. That was very real to me. As opposed to like, who am I and let me just express myself authentically, right? I felt that. I remember feeling that. I think the other thing that's interesting here, and I'll turn to you, Carrie, is, and she doesn't mention it here, Judith Butler, but I think it's really an important point, which is this, the idea that people could change their gender or identify differently or identify as non-gendered, I think it's destabilizing to people who think gender is simple. Just the existence of these other people living in these different ways that don't fit the gender binary, it really bugs some people. It's destabilizing to them, I think. Because I think it's true that it is changing reality and people recognize that and it bothers them. Thoughts? Any extra thoughts on performance?
I mean, I think one, so it's funny because you will hear people throw around Judith Butler's name because she/they, like she actually goes as both.
Yeah, she goes by they. Yeah. You're right.
She'll use both feminine.
I just said
and,
she goes by they. Brothers. That's not how you're supposed to do it.
She actually will use both feminine and the they, them. But looking at, right, you know, you'll see the name kind of thrown around as being associated with these gender theories. But I guarantee you no one has actually, like, the books are very dense, right? You said you were trying to make it through one of them. Dude, this is not easy reading.
No. I read her most recent one, Who's Afraid of Gender? Mm-hmm. And I really liked it, but it's a bit of a slog. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. I mean, no one, she has brilliant ideas. Not the world's most riveting writer.
Nor narrator. I was listening to her narrate her own thing. Unbelievable.
But I think that actually contributes some to, right, it is a complex theory, and it often is misconstrued. And I think sometimes we even hear the word performance, right? And we think like, oh, it's if you go to a theater, right? And I put on a persona and I can just put it on and take it off. That's not really what this is talking about, right? The idea of gender performance is that most of this is happening unconsciously. There are some times in our lives, middle school, right? Other things like that, right? Going out on a first date with someone, whatever else, that gender might become super salient. And then all of a sudden gender performance becomes very much conscious. But most of this is presumed to be going on in the kind of unconscious background from years and years of kind of learning what it is, how I'm supposed to hold my body in space because I'm a woman and I'm not a man, right? How I'm supposed to interact with other people. It's years of unconscious sort of training. So it's not just a matter of turning something on and off when we're kind of looking at performance. But it does, right, kind of reflect this idea of gender is something that we do rather than gender is something that we are, right? The idea that this is something that happens in our interactions with other people. And that very much kind of changes the way, right, that you look at what gender is and its potential flexibility.
Which could be very freeing, right? Like, I could look at it as very freeing. You could look at it as very freeing. I don't have to act like a prototypical male. There's nothing about me that requires it,
right,
essentially, in Judith Butler. And I think she's very convincing in this. But again, it's this, what happens then is this destabilization of a category that people count on to be simple, I think.
Yeah, Yeah.
So the destabilization is freedom, but freedom is also like scary.
Absolutely.
For some people, right?
Yeah. And you can get into even much bigger kind of theoretical things, right? And I mean, one of the ideas that why do people have sometimes such a visceral reaction to changing gender norms, to suggesting that things might not be binary. And part of it, at least, is probably the fact that we have built our whole societies around gender and gender difference, right? So if we start to poke holes at, well, how natural are these gender differences actually, right? Are these really as innate and kind of, you know, inevitable as we believe them to be? Then it's going to also start poking holes at, well, does it make sense that we treat men and women differently if they're not actually as different as we think they are, right? So it's all connected. And so I think the word destabilizing is very accurate in the sense that it feels personally threatening, right, to someone who does not want to change the status quo when we see, right, these things kind of being discussed.
Right. It doesn't require them to change.
No.
It requires them to allow the categories to be less clear and to allow people to live with more freedom within those. Mm-hmm. It doesn't require them to do that, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it might in some ways require them to change the way that they think about their own identity only in the sense that we're taught that it's such a big part of our identities, right? And that then if I am very much, you know, living my whole life believing this is an important part of who I am and somebody comes along and says, actually, right, this might not be as essential as you thought it was, right? That can feel, I think, threatening to my own self-perception, even though, yes, it doesn't actually require them to do anything differently, right, than what they're already doing or how they're identifying or anything like that. But it feels at a kind of, you know, gut level, I think, threatening because of that.
Yeah. I think so. And it's funny because I used to think like it was weird that we used phobia, like transphobia or homophobia. But having read Butler and thought more about specifically gender, I think it is fear really that's underlying a lot of people's inability to accept these other ways of being. I think it is a genuine fear, even if they are not fully acknowledging the fear. I think they feel it. Okay, I am going to pick. I had two clips here. I don't know if you know about this. In Oklahoma, the University of Oklahoma or Oklahoma University, whatever it is, there was this student that was asked to write a reflection paper on a gender article, and she did, and she got a zero. She didn't like that, and she complained all the way to the governor, and it became kind of national news that you may or may not have seen. The good news is this is going to sum it up for you. Now, I'm choosing the more spicy summary. I had two summaries here. One's pretty standard. This one's a little spicier, a little more fun, a little harder on the student, not going to lie. Might feel uncomfortable, but we're going to see what happens. Here we go.
I do think they're doing the right thing by putting the TA on administrative leave. If you can't do your job right in any setting, you get fired. So there's a lot of misinformation being spread online about what happened. So
we are live once again with America's favorite game show, Google is Free. As always, I'm your host, Chad Almanac, and this is the show where our contestants try to use the free search engine Google to make some sort of sense out of the crazy videos we see on the internet. Okay, everyone, please welcome back our contestant, Marcus. We are so happy to have you back, Marcus.
Oh, it's good to be back, Chad. Let's do this.
Oof, Marcus is eager to jump in, which means there's probably no point in me even starting the timer because he's already done. There we go. What did you find, Marcus?
So she was given an article that outlined a study from 2013 where they had children report the gender typicality and popularity of their peers, and they found a correlation between the two. So basically, her assignment was to present a thoughtful reaction to the material presented in the article. Marcus, I am begging you, what was this woman's thoughtful interpretation of this study, its data, and most importantly, its conclusion?
Nuh-uh, because God.
What? That's it. She wrote 5 full pages about God and men and women have roles. So actually, this study is wrong because I say so. And bullying kids into conforming to my God is what should be happening. And it makes me very upset. My classmates don't agree. Well, actually, they're too scared to agree because they're all sheep. But I won't be. And also, women were created by God to be helpers. Don't you know that? Anyone who dares believe this hogwash must be a demon.
And if I say I don't believe you, what happens then?
I could tell you verbatim in her own words how she chose to summarize her thoughts on the article. Would that suffice? Yes, please. Now. Overall, reading articles such as this one encourage me to one day raise my children, knowing that they have a heavenly father who loves them and cherishes them deeply, and that having their identity firmly rooted in who he is will give them the satisfaction and acceptance that the world can never provide for them. My prayer for the world, and specifically for American society and youth, is that they would not believe the lies being spread from Satan that make them believe they are better off as another gender than what God made them. I pray that they feel God's love and acceptance as who he originally created them to be.
So she didn't do the assignment, right?
She didn't do her assignment.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
And then she blamed her instructor, Mel Kurth, a graduate student who was given Oklahoma's Outstanding Graduate Teaching Award by the Department of Psychology 3 weeks ago, even though she explained how she literally didn't do the assignment and that this has nothing to do with religious beliefs. But I forgot. She's trans. That's why she failed her. It's not like another instructor for the same class reaffirmed why she was getting a 0 and gave identical reasoning as to why she was comfortable with giving her a 0. It was all these demon trans people. That's why she doesn't know how to relay thoughts and information coherently or demonstrate basic reading comprehension skills.
Okay. What'd you think? Was it too hard on the young woman? I'm really debating this one in my heart, to be honest. And not just on this one, but on all things like this, to be honest, where in this case, a religious person chooses just to talk about their religion as if that is entirely authoritative and not bother with anything in the article whatsoever, or in some ways, not bother with anything anybody's studying that doesn't work with their view of the world. I've grown very tired, which is why I gave you the harsher one. This is not an uncommon way for gender to be treated. Increasingly, in our political environment, this is what this woman wrote here defines for a good deal of people in the United States. I can show you some graphs if we have time. That's it. You don't need to engage with gender studies at all. It doesn't matter. It's uninteresting. Do you face this at, you teach in a Christian setting that's challenging on this subject. How do you manage that a little bit when you have to?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, hearing stories like this, and you're like, okay, that is a lot. I can, fortunately, have not received many papers that are just kind of going, I mean, what strikes me about this video is, I don't know if you noticed, the article itself was just about gender typicality. It's not even about gender identity or transgender kids or anything. It's just about how, like, boy or girl like they are at recess, right? And so
gender typicality, just will you explain what that is?
Gender typicality is just basically like how much do you conform to the stereotypes going around. It's not anything about how you identify. It's just like, if I'm a boy, how much do I feel like that means I have to wear blue, right? Versus, am I okay sometimes wearing pink, right? Or whatever else, right? And like how I act on the playground, those sort of things. That's actually what gender typicality is. It has nothing to do with wanting to be a different gender or any of those things, right? And so, not only, even the, you know, discussion just wasn't even pertinent to the article, right? Let alone, right? And so, right, I can see the situation where that puts somebody in a very difficult position. It puts administrators in a very difficult situation in a world where you don't want all of a sudden the larger U.S. administration's attention to be on your school, right? You end up with situations where, yeah, someone gets laid off, right? And I know there's an investigation pending. I don't know what that will show, right? But I do think it feels scary, right? To feel like that is something and that, I mean, yeah, like you're saying, this is a state university, right?
Not even a private university.
It's not
a Christian college.
University or anything like that. And so I think...
I mean, it is Oklahoma.
Fair.
I think we should just remember that.
There are differences.
Sorry, Oklahoma. I don't have a good impression of you at the moment.
But I think that, yeah, I mean, I have had occasionally in the past, right, individuals who... Right, the paper is supposed to be drawing on stuff we talked about in class, and it's just not, right? And it wouldn't matter if your beliefs lined up entirely with mine or not, right? The fact is, you didn't cite the article once or any of these types of things, right? And so, yeah, and even if you know, and I don't know all the details of this particular situation and, right, how that played out.
The governor of Oklahoma got involved eventually,
right.
Which... That didn't help.
Right. No. And so, yeah, we've got a situation where it sounds like the, instructor very clearly explained why the grade was given in such a way. But at the end of the day, that...
It didn't matter.
Didn't matter.
That's right.
So, yeah, I do think it feels different.
Yeah.
Right? It feels like that's not something I would have even, occurred to me. Even like 3 or 4 years ago, right? Like mm-hmm. People are always upset and can get upset about these things, but there's a difference between, right? I mean, I would never want to be the administrator at a college in general, right? But particularly maybe a Christian college, right? Because I know they get phone calls about anything under the sun. I mean, not even just gender, right? In terms of things like that people don't agree with. And that, I think, is kind of part of what people have just accepted. Yeah, you'll have a parent who's upset about whatever. This is just a whole nother level, right? Of it's not just I'm complaining to an institution, but it's saying, hey, I'm going to bring this and expect the government to get involved in censoring what is happening in the universe. That is frightening to me.
Yeah. Well, she framed it as discrimination against her as a Christian. That was the way it was framed
right. And
taken seriously as that.
Yes.
Which I don't think is going away anytime soon, unfortunately. Okay, I'm going to end with one last video from Judith Butler. Just kind of sums up, I think, for me, and I think Carrie agrees, that this struggle on gender is part of a much bigger struggle. And if there's going to be some kind of success on gender freedom... It's probably going to require a broad coalition that looks out for all kinds of marginalized people who are being targeted.
Now I'm less interested in defending a theory of gender. I'm much more concerned with finding creative and effective ways of countering the attack on gender. One problem is that many people who refuse to allow trans people to define themselves is that they feel that their own self-definition is destabilized. The idea that we can change reality, transform reality to be more open, inclusive, just, less violent, there's an instability in that that's very frightening to people who want to understand their genders as fixed, but is anybody's gender necessary and universal, or is it a complicated emergence that happens with each of us? Our deepest sense of self is also formed in time, and we can't always know in advance what that will be. Freedom is a struggle because there's so much in our world that's telling us not to be free with our bodies. And if we are seeking to love in a free way, to live and move in a free way, we actually have to struggle to claim that freedom. When we live in a democracy, we assume that we're living according to certain principles: equality, freedom, justice. And yet we're constantly learning what freedom is and what equality is and what justice can be. And those challenges, right, the anti-slavery movement, the suffrage movement, the movement for LGBTQIA plus rights, I mean, each of those struggles involve challenging people's existing ideas of who's equal, who has the right to be free, and how do we define justice? We are all the time struggling to achieve that goal. We need to reoccupy these notions and show that concerns with racial justice and gender equality and gender freedom are an integral part of any democratic struggle, especially if we want to rethink who the people are and what it means for them to live in freedom without fear.
So I don't think this attack on gender is going away. I think it's just kind of gathering steam, and I think it's going to continue, and I think it's going to be a big part and a complicated part of the future of American culture and politics. Any final thoughts on this? Anything you want to say about this particular piece of it?
I mean, yeah, I agree that it's a much bigger conversation than just gender, right? And so gender is fitting into this broader sort of landscape where we see groups, right, not only being marginalized, but there being, right, this kind of condoning of the marginalization, right, where more so than we even saw, right, in, you know, if we go back 5 years or so. So just the idea that it's okay to do this, that this is rationalized, this is justified, and it is gender, right, but that because gender is so connected to all these other things, right? Gender is connected to sexuality. Gender is connected to sex. Gender is, I mean, gendered people also have races, right? And socioeconomic status, right? So all this stuff just becomes very interconnected. And so when we're talking about democracy and rights for people, it's kind of a part of all of those conversations, yeah.
Absolutely. And that would be, you sort of hinted at a term, and you didn't say it, but intersectionality was around what you were saying there, meaning it's more complicated to be transgender and a person of color than to be transgender and white, just to give one example. I'll just do this chart real quick, because you were saying, like, it's acceptance of transgender people in general. This is not exactly that question, but you can see, so here it's 2017, and 54% think sex is determined, gender is determined by sex at birth. 2021 goes up to 56. 2022 it goes up to 60, and now this is 2024 and it's at 65%. So for us, well, I'll speak for myself, but I believe also for you, we're looking for these graphs to be going in the opposite direction, towards more acceptance that gender is not simply the sex you were assigned at birth, but much more complicated. And for some reason, partially I think it's because we have an entire movement on the right devoted to this, we are seeing this acceptance of transgender people go in the opposite direction, which is kind of what you were hinting at. Questions. This is the part where we open up for questions for those who have them. I'll come to you with the mic.
Do you see anything legitimate in the concern over transgender men competing in sports as women?
Good one, hot one.
So when you say legitimate, I mean, I guess it depends on, right? So I do think that that is probably one of the more complicated, right? I mean, if we had a range of different things that people, right, like to, you know, take fire at, I would say that for me personally, right, that does become complicated, right? Just because we do know there are obviously hormonal things, right, that are different. I also, at the same time, within men and within women as categories, there are huge differences in their hormones and testosterone and all those kind of things, right? And so I think it's not a simple answer because we don't say somebody, if we're like, hey, as long as you have a vagina, but you're very masculine and you have high testosterone, it's fine. You can compete with the women, right? But if you don't, then, right? So it's weird the way that we're kind of parsing because we're not giving, you know, hormonal cutoffs for other things to make things absolutely 100% fair within gender. And so I think it's more complicated, but I also can see, right, the perspective of where we do want to make sure that things, right, are going to be fair and even. Obviously, you would want to make sure people weren't misusing, right, this in order to. So I am a runner, right, and was reading something, right, about, right, a lot of marathons will have a kind of, you know, non-binary category and trying to figure out how to make that a real category that's a real space for people and not like a way for people like, oh, I didn't qualify for the men's, so I'll call it, right, which is not the intention. And it's honestly disrespectful to the individuals who just want to go and run and have a place to be able to do that. And so, yeah, it's not a great answer to your question, but I do think that it has some complications, and I don't know that, you know, everyone has figured out exactly what that should look like.
I will say, Judith, I did hear Judith Butler say somewhere else that she said there are two things. So she said similarly, she was like, it is complex. It's not simple, this particular issue within the transgender issue, right? But she said, if we keep these two things in mind as we try and figure it out as a guide, it will be helpful. And those were equality and inclusion, right? A lot of people are worried about the equality angle, typically. These are men, these are trans women assigned male at birth. They have an unfair advantage in women's sports, right? That's the equality angle, right? And then usually the inclusion angle is less important. She's saying, can we keep these two things as equally important, work together in sort of like good faith, where we trust that transgender people are authentic people, trying to be good, authentic people in the world, and that they want to do this thing that other people get to do? Will we try and work together to make that happen in a way that honors equality and inclusion? I thought that was a pretty good rubric for trying to think about it. Anybody else?
Thank you both. I understand this particular question invites a lot more complexity, and so I'm not looking for you to, you know, address all of this completely, but wondering if you might even have some resources to speak to, because understanding that something that you teach on is relationships, and, you know, the word destabilizing was spoken a bit, and I think that that captures it well, and so this also invites the question of how do we continue to view changes in relationships, commitments, polyamory, and these kinds of things. And I just wondered if you could speak a bit to that, or also even just if you have resources or things that you would recommend us take a look at.
Yeah, I mean, so I would say I don't necessarily see that as being directly connected to the changes in gender, right? I mean, so gender roles have changed relationships, right? When it comes to things like polyamory or whatever else, right? I mean, that's kind of its own bucket over here, I would say. I think that there is a lot of potential, honestly, for relationships if we start to think more critically about gender. I think we tend to think about it as a thing that is destabilizing, right, for relationships, for families, but inherently it's not, right? If done correctly, this would be provide more stability, right? We actually see that there are really interesting gender differences between heterosexual, right, and couples of the same sex, in part because of these kind of like differences that we've been socialized into that then become real areas of impasse in heterosexual relationships, right? That can take decades to try to unlearn. I mean, we tell men, don't share their emotions. And then we tell women, make men share their emotions, right? And I mean, just as an example. And that is honestly a huge issue in a ton of relationships. And so I think for me, I kind of push back on the idea that, oh, if we challenge gender, that somehow destabilizes, right? If we let people define their genders in ways that feel true to themselves, right? If anything, that kind of institutionalization and support around that is going to provide more support for families, right? Families do better when they aren't marginalized, right? Families do better when they are not under constant stress. And so I think, you know, total different kind of side thing, you know, if you're looking at things like polyamory and like whether that could work and all of that, right? That's kind of in its own bucket. And I have, you know, my own kind of opinions. There's some research on it. But I think that, yeah, when it comes
to... Should we define polyamory real quick? Just
yes.
So we make sure everybody knows what
yeah,
we're talking
we can try.
I know it's a little bit off subject, but
no, I mean there's different definitions. Broadly speaking, polyamory would be referring to being in a kind of, you know, committed, loving relationship with more than one person at a time. And that could manifest itself in different ways, right? It doesn't always look the same. It's different technically than like an open relationship or something like that, right? So there's different things, and there has been some research, right, that kind of looks at it. It's pretty small sample sizes, so, you know, you have to take it with a grain of salt. But yes, we do see there is some stuff within like kind of psychology research starting to look at some of that.
One thing, anybody else have any questions? I'll start walking toward you. But I was just going to say one thing, which is like, if gender can become less binary, less restrictive, I think one of the things that concerns a lot of people is like surgical interventions on teens and young adults, because that just feels very permanent, right? And we worry that they're going to do that and they're going to regret it. It's pretty uncommon, the regret, if I'm not mistaken. Fairly uncommon. Let me finish this and I'll ask you to respond on that. But if it feels like whatever body you're in allows for lots of different expressions, some of which is considered typically feminine and some of which is considered typically male, right? Female, male. But it's fine. It's like socially acceptable. Then I sort of wonder, and we talked about this, if the idea of like needing to physically change your gender because you identify more as the other, if that just kind of falls away because the gender expression is open enough for people to express themselves in the ways they see that feels good to them. You might still have gender dysphoria, right? But some of that might go away, possibly.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really interesting thought question. One I don't see being able to actually test in principle. But yeah, to what extent if we could remove some of these boxes, right, and say that to the extent that, right, it's like I feel so out of place, right, that, I mean, nobody wants to get a surgery or go through these various things, right, but that would seem like the most honest and the least painful option, right? Yeah, would it be possible if we loosen some of these kind of moral constraints on what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, that for at least a sizable portion of people, right? It might not alleviate it for all individuals, but for a sizable portion of people, that this could reduce some of that dysmorphia, right? And they might be able to find a way of living with their bodies without having to change them, and be able to be a kind of whole person without just trying to fit into a different box, right? Because ultimately, it's not really solving the problem, right? It might be solving their personal problem at the moment, but broader socially, we're still keeping boxes, right? We're just saying, okay, fine, we'll let you be in that box, right? But if we could just loosen the barriers on the boxes, maybe we wouldn't have to do that in the first place.
Anybody else? Another one. We'll allow it.
To what extent is this gender bit an artifact of 21st century affluent wealth? Stereotypically, if you are part of a subsistence hunter-gatherer culture, do you actually have a choice? Do you even think about it?
Yeah, so could you define what you mean by gender bit? You said, does this gender bit have to, like, what are you referring to?
The whole conversation about gender, the gender studies, is that what you mean? Would this not be a thing we studied in, or would hunter-gatherers not study gender? Is that what you mean?
I'm sorry I used that word. I didn't even realize I had used it.
Oh, it's not. I'm just genuinely trying to make sure I understand your question.
Is the very fact that we talk about gender as a category all its own, apart from male, female, if you will, biology, an artifact of 21st century affluence?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting question. I don't know if I'd go as far as to say it's an artifact, but it definitely is affluence that allows, right, for the freedom to even think about those types of things, right? I think you're absolutely right. If you look back at a subsistence culture, right, where I am trying to just get by, I need to have as many children as possible so that they can work on my farm and we are making ends meet. I don't have the luxury of identifying myself, right? I mean, and that's not true just of gender, right? That's true of any number of things that we currently hold important to ourselves, right? Whether it's occupational identity, whether it's, you know, looking at different parts of ourselves that historically I think we could argue were not things that people had the luxury to pay attention to. And so I don't think that sometimes when I think the word artifact, it suggests that it's not real. I don't think I would say that it's just an artifact, something that's created by our affluent society, right? I think it reflects real differences. But just as we've seen, right, kind of, you know, homosexuality, right, or different sexual orientations throughout time, but how that would have been lived and whether that would be part of one's identity versus something that, like, all right, well, I need to have my kids, so it's kind of irrelevant, right, who I'm sexually attracted to or not, right? I think that that changes the, you know, in living in an affluent society and as the world, right, grows slowly towards, right, having more space to engage these things. I think it definitely provokes more of these kind of conversations and that there is this idea of trying to kind of understand the self that, no, I don't think we probably did, right, in the same way if you go back a couple thousand years.
Anyone else? Okay. Scott's going to come up here and close this out.
I'm Scott Nagelvoort. I'm on the board of Still Processing, and when I woke up this morning, I wasn't supposed to do the close, so this is always a dangerous thing when they ask me to do it on the fly, but here we go, nonetheless. I want to thank you for your questions. I actually thought those questions were really interesting. But as importantly, I really want to thank you for your answers. The answer to your first one, I really liked what you said, that there isn't a simple answer. And I think that that leads to still processing. Your second answer I could get into a lot more, but for now, I really do appreciate what you said there. So you've heard about, we're hiring Josh, it's still processing, that's exciting. Next year, we're going to have upwards of 20 events, and that's also exciting. I think we live in a complicated, complex world. If you're curious, still processing is the place for you. Come hear about all those interesting things next year. We've got a lot of interesting things on tap, and it will absolutely make a difference in your life. It's been my absolute pleasure for a lot of years to walk with Marlon and Josh, and I'm thrilled to see this still processing thing come to be. It's been a joy of my life to support this. If you like what we do here, I encourage you to join us as well. We can use your support. What we do is for all of us, and it'll take all of us to make it continue. So thank you for being here, and happy holidays.
Thank you, Scott. And Carrie, thank you so much for all your wisdom and for being here.
Thank you.